Black and Muslim in Minnesota, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. In Minnesota, two big issues are coming together, Black Lives Matter and fear of Muslim immigrants. And that's making life hard for young Somali Americans living in the Twin Cities.
Technically, we have it double as bad because we're Muslim and Black. And I feel like a lot of Muslims are coming to that realization.
Plus, some new emojis for your smartphone that right some wrongs when it comes to gender equality.
There can be female equestrians, female swimmers, female weightlifters.
It's amazing to think that that hasn't been the case.
Yes, it is. And people have been calling out for this for a long time.
Those stories, plus a history lesson in Olympic flag dipping, ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us this Friday. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has done it again. He's waded into an issue using the kind of language that can only be called divisive. He told an audience in Maine last night that Maine is a major destination for Somali refugees and that they're coming from, quote, some of the most dangerous places. You can imagine how that went down in the Somali community there. People are pretty hurt and angry. We've been thinking a lot about Somali Americans here on the show recently. My colleague Rupa Shenoy, host of our podcast Otherhood about the immigrant experience, is just back from reporting in the Twin Cities in Minnesota about the Somali American community there. She's now launching the second season of her podcast Otherhood. This is the first episode. It's a really important one. It's very timely. And Rupa, I just want you to explain why you went back to Minnesota, which is a place you've lived and reported in before.
Minnesota has been at the center of two major forces that the United States is facing right now, and that is terrorism and police tensions with communities. So for a few years, they've had major cases of young Somali Americans going abroad to work for terror groups, and they've had many arrests and cases of that. So the government started a program aimed at outreach to Somali communities, identifying at-risk youth. And the community took this as something where the government was looking for informants. So there's been an increasing climate of distrust inside the community and toward the government there. So a lot of the emotions that have been brought up by this Trump comment have been there for a very long time. And then at the same point, they've had a major clash with police. Last year, there was the death of Jamar Clark. He was an unarmed Black man who witnesses say was shot while his hands were handcuffed behind his back. And then, as you know, about a month ago, there was the death of Philando Castile. And that is the case that was live streamed on Facebook by his girlfriend. He was stopped for a broken taillight. And after that, the protests in Minnesota were constant. And I had been there. I had worked from 2010 to 2014 for Minnesota Public Radio. And I had covered many police-involved shootings, as they're called, of unarmed Black men. And people there were telling me now that Somalis were a big part of the Black Lives Matter protests. And so I went there and I talked to the kids who were, or the young Somalis who are taking action to bring these two communities together.
Let's have a listen to an excerpt from your podcast now. This is Otherhood.
Minnesota churches and nonprofits found a home for thousands of families displaced by the Somali Civil War. For Filson Ibrahim's family, that home ended up being in a small, slightly remote, very white Minnesota town.
Which I joke that it was kind of a hellhole, but I don't know how appropriate that is. But it is, it's somewhat true because for an outsider, like, they don't make it easy.
We're in a room with a bunch of Filson's friends at Augsburg College, where she's working on an environmental studies degree. Filson's 27 and small, like me, with a hijab tucked into a jean jacket.
They, like, let you know how you don't belong in this community and how you need to go back. And, yeah, it's a challenging space to grow up.
How did you deal with it?
We just had a very tiny community. Like, I grew up in townhouses, so majority of the people that lived around me and my neighbors were Somali. But yeah, we just held it down, like whatever we needed. We took care of each other. Like, we were transporting our kids to high schools. We would, like, shop for each other. We would check up on each other if, like, our parents were working. So we were just our own community.
And then what happened?
And then I moved up to the cities in 2008.
That's about the time things started to dramatically change for Somalis in Minnesota. Dozens of young Somali men left or tried to leave to join a terrorist group in Somalia. In response, the Justice Department created a program to identify youth at risk of radicalization.
And that's where the problem comes in, because there aren't any guidelines or any like proven data of who or what a radicalized youth looks like.
Somali youth felt singled out for scrutiny and suspicion, Filson says, similar to the way African Americans have been feeling for generations. But she says Somali Americans have thought of themselves as different from Black Americans and held themselves apart.
Having our countries being colonized by the Western civilization, that anti-Blackness runs deep with us. A lot of us, a lot of my parents, a lot of like our grandparents think that like being white equals you having power, and being Black is the opposite of that. So a lot of us have innate hatred for who we are and just generally for Black people. I think like that divide and conquer mentality works very well. It has worked and it works very well to this day. Organizations that bring us to America warn us about African Americans. Like a lot of immigrants that came to America, a lot of us have been told not to speak with or talk to and be weary and like limit the interactions that we have with African Americans, because they tend to be scary, they tend to be violent, they tend to be gang members. So we have the mentality coming in to America.
What helped you get there? Because I had the similar experiences too.
That's Filson's friend Awali Osman, a Somali-American who organizes a debate league for Somali high schoolers at Augsburg. He's tall and lanky and usually has a big smile.
What helped you make the change from, you know, what was taught to you and where you are now?
That's a good question.
It is a good question. That's
such a good question. Mm-hmm. I think just unlearning everything that I learned in school. Like every history class that I was a part of in school turned out to be a lie.
In America.
In America. And then having conversations with other Black folks and being friends with Black folks and slowly but surely like seeing that, hey, we deal with the same stuff. Like, oh, you go to the store, you get followed, I get followed.
So you guys like became adults as the kids going abroad was happening and the Black Lives Matter was happening.
It's what a time to be alive, right? Like all these tensions are bubbling up. People are finding who they are and voicing their opinion louder than ever before.
Did this help you understand it?
I feel like not understand it, but like it made it okay to feel what I'm feeling. Like growing up, being a minority or being a different group, it's like your anger is like a cake, but the frosting is like all wrapped up and pretty and designed. Like you don't really see what's in it. You feel frustrated or angry, but you never know where or like why this is happening to you, because it's all like wrapped up nicely. But having people show up like Black Lives Matter and then say, hey, this is happening to our community. You're disturbing us. You've been disturbing us and we're not having this. You're like, hey, I feel that too. Like, this is my life. So we're trying to, like, unblur a lot of lines and say that we are Black because the system sees us just as that. I mean, technically, we have it double as bad because we're Muslim and Black. And I feel like a lot of Muslims are coming to that realization.
That's Filson Ibrahim, one of the voices in the newest episode of Otherhood, a podcast produced here at The World by my colleague Rupa Shenoy. You can find the full episode of Otherhood over at PRI.org and also on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. The Rio Olympics officially get underway with tonight's opening ceremony, and still organizers are facing all sorts of complaints about everything from dirty water and disease to insecurity and general disorganization. Turns out that may be pretty close to the original Olympic experience centuries ago in ancient Greece. David Clay Large has a lovely story on all this in Foreign Policy. Large is a historian at the University of San Francisco and UC Berkeley and joins me now. Let's start with the idea of insecurity. In Brazil, there are fears of muggers and terrorists, but what did the ancients have to fear?
Yes, the world of the ancient Olympics was so embroiled in constant fighting back and forth between rival city-states that every time the Olympics took place, there was a fear of some kind of attack, some kind of disruption, as a consequence of which they organized a so-called Olympics truce. The idea here was that there couldn't be any attacks specifically on the games themselves, and that fans going to and from the sacred site wouldn't be under attack as normally was the case. Now, the fact is that even this Olympic truce often broke down. Famously, in 364 BC, when soldiers from the city of Elis actually invaded the Olympic grounds in order to retrieve protection rights over the games that had been taken away from them in the years before. So there was a bloody battle going on right during the wrestling competition in 364 in ancient Olympia, and this was emblematic of the constant problems of security that faced those games. The Spartans were also a problem. They had been banned from the Olympics for many years. They themselves thought the Olympics were not bloody enough in any event for their taste, but they did show up in the 420. And they got themselves banned once again for extracurricular fighting.
So
and also perhaps for the fact they smelled bad. I mean, they didn't bathe, the Spartans. They didn't believe in bathing. And, you know, the ancient Greeks took their hygiene seriously.
Spectacle upon spectacle. Rio is also battling problems with polluted water and backed up toilets in the Olympic Village. And you've talked about the smelly bodies. But what did the ancient Greeks have to wrestle with in terms of sanitary issues?
Huge sanitary problems, because of course they didn't have any modern sewage at all. What they did is they built these trench-like latrines for the visitors in their thousands who came from all over. These latrines were extremely unsanitary, to put it mildly. They attracted all kinds of bugs, flies. There were outbreaks of various kinds of gastrointestinal diseases, diarrhea, often fatal, as a result of the poor hygiene and the poor water. There was often no water, running water at all during the festivals, because they were held in the high summer, and this was a barren place in any event. So this was a recipe for heat stroke. Lots of people died from heat stroke. It was a real problem. The issues surrounding Rio today are nothing compared to those of ancient Greece when it comes to matters of pollution and hygiene.
Nothing, huh? But please tell me there was no doping or cheating.
Well, of course there was. It's often assumed somehow these ancient games were purer than the modern ones. But in fact, if anything, they were, well, even more corrupt, perhaps. You have to remember that the athletes were not competing largely for themselves as freelance amateurs. Rather, they were paid champions of specific cities or city-states. They fought under the banners of those city-states. Of course, they couldn't wear uniforms because they were nude. But everybody knew that the great athletes represented particular cities, and there was a lot on the line for them in terms of pay and rewards, as a consequence of which they did a lot of cheating. And they did a lot of what we would call doping. Now, they didn't have sophisticated modern dope, obviously, in the ancient period, but they did have herbs, various kinds of herbal concoctions. They had some opiates that they mixed together to make cocktails. They also overdosed, if you will, on testicles and raw meat in order to strengthen themselves for the games. And they cheated. They sometimes cast spells on their opponents. If they were racing in the chariots, they would fiddle with the opponent's chariot rigs in order to make the wheels fall off and that sort of thing. This was quite commonplace, so commonplace that there were fines instituted for cheats. There were statues, monuments sprinkled around the ancient site, admonishing athletes and judges, for that matter, not to cheat. But many did, and so fines were collected and used both to pay the priests and to build more monuments against cheating.
Well, thank you for destroying my image of the ancient Olympics. I'm not sure I wanted to know any of that, but thank you, Olympic historian David Clay Large.
Thank you very much.
You're with The World. Imagine the places you live and work and play slowly slipping beneath the sea. It's almost impossible to imagine, really. But it is starting to happen in some places around the globe. Low-lying spots like Bangladesh and the Maldives that are on the front lines of global sea level rise. Right now, though, we're going to visit two such hot spots right here in the U.S. They're both tiny islands that are literally disappearing. One's in the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, and The World's Carolyn Beeler will take us there in a few minutes. But first, we're going to head to southern Louisiana and a part of the Gulf Coast that's seeing the highest relative sea level rise in the country. One small community there has been fighting rising water for decades, but residents have finally decided to give up the fight. Here's that story from reporter Molly Peterson.
The Ile de Jean Charles is about 75 miles southwest of New Orleans in kind of the tattered lace part of the state, where it's all washing into the Gulf of Mexico. I've known a guy named Albert Nakan there since after Hurricane Katrina. He's the chief of the Biloxi Chittimacha Choctaw tribe. They've called the Ile de Jean Charles home for more than 200 years. When I met Chief Albert a decade ago, he didn't really believe in climate change. Now he says he sees it.
Where I was born and I raised that, you can't walk anymore. You sink up to your knees if you go try to walk in there. So something is happening.
Sea level rise is happening, but it's complicated here. Dams now hold back Mississippi River silt that used to replenish the land here. Oil and gas canals have cut up the marshes. Both lead to more erosion. But there's also growing acceptance of the role of climate change. You can really feel what's going on here along a narrow road that connects the island to the rest of Louisiana. This road was rebuilt higher since my last visit, but water still splashes over it.
We tried just last week to get down here. We could not.
Chantel Comerdale grew up on the island, but she doesn't live here anymore.
It's a safety issue now. My dad turned his truck around. There was waves crashing on his truck. It's here. It's now. It's real.
Others in her family feel the risk, too. We're on the porch of a house 14 feet in the air, crowded with relatives. It belongs to Chantel's grandfather, Wen Billiot. He's almost 90. Last time I met Wen, he was intent on staying forever. Now he's not so sure.
I don't know how long the people are going to stay over here. I really don't know. Everything's been going faster and faster.
That's about eroding land. Storms also hit harder now and are harder to recover from. But leaving is still hard. Wen's grandson Kyle remembers how it was in 1985 when back-to-back storms forced his family to move inland. He was 9.
It was hard for me, leaving this place. I don't know if it was just because of family. You was always in nature. I mean, we always had something to do.
Kyle's 40 now. Gas has been disconnected to the island. A big storm could also end phone and water service. And if the road washes out, it won't be replaced.
They can't save the island. Just the things that you would have to deal with living down here.
The final turning point came earlier this year when the federal government offered the tribe $48 million to move inland. It would be the first federal tax money ever used to move a whole community due to climate change. And the Biloxi Chittimacha Choctaw tribe finally decided it was time to go. The hope here is that with the federal help, the tribe can at least stay together.
Reporter Molly Peterson there on the Ile de Jean Charles in southern Louisiana. The World's Carolyn Beeler is here with me now. Carolyn, you worked with Molly on this project. Where are the folks there actually going to go now that they've decided to leave?
They don't actually know yet. They still have to submit a relocation plan to authorities. But something they are doing is they're already consulting with other communities from around the globe who are facing similar issues to help them sort of figure out this big job of potential relocation.
That makes sense. It's such a big change. So, Carolyn, for your part of this project, you went to that second island we talked about in the Chesapeake Bay.
I did. And like in southern Louisiana, the Chesapeake is a hotspot for sea level rise for a bunch of different reasons. So I went to Tangier Island, Virginia, where people are also facing a very uncertain future. But the residents there are reacting in totally the opposite way. They are determined to stay.
They're digging in. Okay, so let's listen to that.
Tangier is Virginia's last inhabited island in the Chesapeake. It's about 90 miles southeast of Washington, and many of the roughly 450 people who live here are descendants of the original English settlers from the 1600s. Stepping off the boat is kind of like stepping back in time. There are white picket fences and gingerbread houses. The isolation makes for a very tight-knit community.
The people, they grew up with each other, so it's not just that they're each other's neighbors, it's their family.
That's Teresa Vermeil Tyler.
You can't beat it when it comes to raising kids, you can't.
Tyler's husband is a waterman, like many of the men here. They catch crabs and oysters in the bay.
We've been working the waters for a couple hundred years now.
This is Uker Eskridge, Tangier's mayor. He says these days not everything is right in the bay.
The thing is, the Chesapeake Bay, which has been providing the resource for a living on the island, is now threatening the island.
That's because Tangier is slowly washing away. It's been happening for centuries, but climate change is speeding things up. More land slips under the bay every year. Eskridge took me out on his boat to show me some of the damage. We stop about 100 yards offshore, where it used to be dry land.
They had a small schoolhouse and a small store up here. All of it's underwater now.
The last families left here decades ago, and visiting this spot makes Eskridge reflect on his own fate.
Very discouraging when you look at it. Where we are now on Tangier, we don't have another island to jump to, so we've got to protect the one we're on.
Protect instead of move. That's one big difference between Tangier and the Île de Jean Charles. And there's another one. For the most part, people here on Tangier don't believe in climate change, that pollution is helping to push up sea levels. They think the problem is erosion. Back on the island, former waterman Lonnie Miller tells me he doesn't see sea level rise, but he does see the edges of Tangier getting eaten away by waves.
We don't have no marshes to absorb the water anymore. But is it global warming? No.
What most residents here do believe in is God's will. They say they'll be here as long as God wants them to be. People like George Cannon, who goes by Cook.
The man that made this whole earth and everything, it's all in his timetable.
Now, Tangier doesn't want to leave its fate all in God's hands. Residents want the federal government to build seawalls all the way around the island to protect against erosion, but that could cost millions, and no one's stepping up to pay for it. Meanwhile, the Army Corps of Engineers says sea levels here could rise as much as 6 feet by 2100, and the town of Tangier could be underwater within 25 years.
The World's Carolyn Beeler. Carolyn, it strikes me that Tangier Island and the Île de Jean Charles are really kind of guinea pigs for the challenges of global sea level rise. Is there any kind of plan to help coastal communities deal with this?
There's not, and this is the thing that struck me the most when I was reporting this story. There's no national plan, there's no criteria for who stays and who goes, and this is also the case internationally. Countries have pledged billions of dollars to help, but it's not clear where that money is going or what it's going to do, and this is sort of an existential crisis that's going to be facing a lot more communities.
It's very sobering. Thank you for bringing us these stories. The World's Carolyn Beeler, along with reporter Molly Peterson.
Thanks, Jeb.
You can see photos of what these two islands look like today and maps of what they used to look like on our website, PRI.org. And you're listening to The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. In Berlin, old cemeteries are being repurposed. One's becoming a park, and another has been turned into a garden tended by refugees.
Cultivating human beings in the best way possible, which is to show them you're refugees, but you're not a second-class citizen. You're not a nobody.
That story just ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. In some parts of the U.S., it's not unusual to hear stories about local cemeteries running out of room, especially in crowded urban areas. But our next story from Germany is about a different sort of trend. In the German capital of Berlin, graveyards are disappearing. They're being converted into public parks, playgrounds, even land for new housing. That might sound creepy to some of you, but in Germany, this trend reflects evolving attitudes about death. Daniel Estrin reports from Berlin.
At this kindergarten playground in central Berlin, kids chase each other on bikes, run around with balloons, and climb on top of tombstones. The playground is built on an old graveyard belonging to the Sophian Church. Christine Schlund is the pastor.
This hasn't been used as a cemetery for much more than 100 years.
This is a
monument. Yes.
This is the base of a grave monument.
Yes, yes.
And now it's just part of the sandbox.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
A few steps away is another grave that's fenced off.
This is the grave of the famous historian Leopold von Ranke. Yeah.
I'd never heard of him, but it turns out he's the father of modern historical scholarship. One can only wonder what he might think about his place in contemporary history next to a sandbox.
People tend to be angry, surprised and angry at having this grave in the middle of the kindergarten. Yeah. Of course, there are also people who think it is strange that children are playing on the former graveyard.
What do you think?
I think it's absolutely no problem. You know, Christian faith is about life. I think by having children playing on the cemetery, the dead are honored in a special way. Yeah.
Burials have gone out of fashion in Berlin. As space started getting tight, cemeteries started charging rental fees on plots, and many people are now choosing cremation instead. Some pay to be buried in a forest cemetery outside Berlin. The urn is buried at the foot of a tree, and a small plaque with the name of the deceased is nailed to the trunk. Jürgen Kvant heads a Protestant association that oversees a number of Berlin cemeteries. He predicts only a quarter of the land in his cemeteries will be used for burials in upcoming decades.
And we have to reflect what will we do with all these cemeteries which are not any longer needed for burials.
Graveyard recycling is not a new practice in Berlin. The kindergarten playground was built atop the cemetery in the 1950s. In the 1970s, a Christian cemetery in the city was converted into a Muslim cemetery to accommodate an influx of Turks. But as the city expands, cemeteries become prime real estate. Kvant says for his cemetery association, it's a money issue. It can't afford to maintain cemeteries when fewer people are paying for plots.
We have no other choice.
One of Kvant's cemeteries is being converted into a park. Another has been partially converted into a cemetery for lesbians. And two graveyards have been appropriated for new housing for some of the million-plus people who fled the Middle East and moved to Germany in the last few years. This graveyard has been mostly cleared of headstones, and in their place is a community garden, including a small Syrian refugee garden with tomatoes and onions and mint. The tombstone carver's workshop at the entrance is now used for German language classes for refugees and to store gardening supplies. Fethullah Tariken is the head gardener here.
It's a space that's been abandoned and used for burying people, used for now gardening and cultivating human beings in the best way possible, which is to show them, you know, you're refugees, but you're not a second-class citizen. You're not a nobody.
And here's a gravestone, right on the corner of the Syrian community garden. Marta Kraus died in 1933. Underneath her name, a motto in German reads, "Unforgettable." Ironic? Yes. But the gardener says it's inevitable. Kvant, who heads the cemetery association, says it's hard watching a cemetery vanish.
I think it's a very, very important place for people to be confronted with the death, to know that we have to die, that we can't live for forever. And if you have no cemeteries in the future, we lose a very important place.
There is one exception to the disappearing cemeteries of Berlin. No one touches the stately graves of famous historical figures, like Leopold von Ranke's grave in the playground. If you're not a famous historical figure, that's all right. For a couple thousand euros, the Cemetery Association will bury you in the grave of a famous historical figure. You'll share a grave with a person so important, chances are you too will be able to rest in peace. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
We have a photo essay, so you can see those former graveyards in Berlin. They're beautiful pictures, but they're a little unsettling if you're not used to seeing kids playing on a jungle gym right next to a tombstone. Check it out at PRI.org. We stay in Germany now for our next story. The German word for office is Büro. Büro, as in bureaucracy. Germany has a lot of bureaus. There's the Federal Office for Migration and Refugees, the Foreign Office, the Citizenship Office. And for new immigrants to Germany, all this bureaucracy can be tough to navigate. That prompted a group of Syrian refugees to build a new smartphone app called Büro Crazy. 23-year-old Munzer Kitab is one of the app's developers.
When we first arrived here, like I was shocked about the bureaucracy that everything I've been through here in Berlin, all about paperwork, all about making things more complicated for us as newcomers, and specifically for us as refugees and a non-speaker of German language. I can tell you a German word. I don't know if you can understand it. Or
try me.
In the first 7 days I have been here in Germany, I have to do a paper called Polizeimeldebescheidigung, the registration paper we got from the citizen's office.
So suddenly you're being asked for these specific pieces of paper and you don't have them and you have to figure out how to get them. So how would the app change that? How does the app work?
The application actually took the forms from the official offices and translated to another language. For now, we have it in Arabic and in English. You can fill it in Arabic or English. Then you will have it in German as a PDF file, and you don't need a translator.
So this is all coding, right? Did you know how to code before you got to Germany?
This is all coding, that's right, but we didn't have any formal experience of coding. So we just came here to Germany and we heard about the Reedy School of Digital Integration. So this is a school for refugees to help them with coding skills. And the first session was brainstorming about the problems that we already had in Germany, the language and the internet connection and the housing, but we all frustrated about us bureaucrats here.
The bureaucracy,
The idea was, like, while we are learning how to code, we have to do something, I mean, to apply it.
What's so interesting is it's a problem for newcomers, but if you come up with a good app, I presume there are an awful lot of people, Germans included, who are going to benefit from it.
Yeah, I hope so. Actually, a lot of people that, even from Germany, that came to us like and told us, this is brilliant. You have to be to make it even for the Germans.
Munzer, I'd love to know a little bit more about your story. How did you come to Germany?
I left Syria in January 2015 to Turkey. I stayed there for 2 or 2.5 months, and it took me 1 month to get to Germany by getting to Greece, Macedonia and Serbia, Hungary, then the last station was Berlin.
So that route that we've heard so much about, it took you 3.5 months?
Yeah, the Balkan way.
And when you think back over that, you know, year and a half, what's the biggest thing been about your experience in Germany?
I think it was a hard year. Specifically in Berlin, the process that we are going through is much, much longer than the other cities. So it took me more than 1 year to get my status. And the second challenge was like finding an apartment, because I moved in Berlin more than 7 times, actually. I just found an apartment last 2 weeks, actually. I just moved in. So things getting better
right now.
Things
are looking up. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, and if your app takes off, you'll certainly be making things easier for people who come after you. Thank you very much. Munzer Kitab is Syrian, now living in Germany, and he's one of the developers of a new app called Bureaucracy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our smartphones are now the way many of us communicate with one another, and that means we're increasingly using emojis to express ourselves. But if you're an Apple iPhone user and a woman, your choice of female emojis is pretty limited. There's a flamenco dancer emoji, a princess emoji, a bride with veil emoji, woman with bunny ears emoji, disappointed face emoji, and weary face emoji. And that's about it for now. But Apple has a new set of emojis due to come out next month for iPhone users, and the world's social media editor, Isis Madrid, is here to tell me about them. What will these emojis look like? Tell me there's one for me.
This new Apple update has people really excited. There are 70 new emojis, or at least there are 70 new emojis and updates on existing emojis. And what I mean by that is that starting in September, every emoji can be male and female. And that's a huge deal, especially right now the Olympics are coming up. There can be female equestrians, female swimmers, female weightlifters.
It's amazing to think that that hasn't been the case.
Yes, it is. And people have been calling out for this for a long time.
And it's so deep because emojis are like language. You know, there's been a crowdsourced all-emoji edition of Moby Dick. When we're talking about gender, how does that language or emojis affect how we think about it?
Emoji is like a language. It's not technically a language. We kind of use emojis within the syntax of our existing language. but they are how we express ourselves and they are how we see ourselves in the digital space. So last year, a study by the University of Warsaw found that countries with gender-neutral languages have a more narrow wage gap. So that's a big deal when you think about what language means and when you open that up to include emojis. It's a big
deal. It affects the way we think and the way we organize ourselves.
And it's a big deal for young women. Women are the biggest users of emojis. I love them.
Can I just say my kid has two moms, and when the emojis came out that showed a family that looked like ours, she was over the moon. I mean, it changed her day, and it made me realize that if you don't see yourself there, it's as if you don't exist.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeb.
So this is a complicated business, how these emojis are regulated. We're talking about Apple's new emojis, but presumably this discussion applies to other phones and companies.
Yes, this is an announcement by Apple, but there's an industry of emoji behind the scenes over in Silicon Valley. The Unicode Consortium kind of codes and standardizes languages for digital spaces. And they do that with ancient languages, with hieroglyphics, with tribal languages. And they also have an emoji subcommittee. And the emoji subcommittee gets all these petitions all year long. You know, can we have a dumpling emoji? Can we have the rainbow flag emoji? The pride flag emoji is another new one this year. And
it
actually,
doesn't sound real. It sounds like a cartoon.
I know. So actually, Google had a new proposal for the Unicode subcommittee earlier this year that represents women and men and gender nonconforming people in 13 new professions, and 11 of them were accepted last month. So that's in the pipeline, and Apple, Microsoft, Android, everyone can use these coded emojis in their upcoming releases.
So you've looked at these emojis. Do you have a favorite of the new ones?
Yes. So not only are women represented in kind of different professions, but men can now show themselves being pampered and being silly and doing all these like femme things. So the women with bunny ears emoji, which is a favorite of mine, that's now going to be available with men.
So to be clear, we're not taking male emojis and just making them female. All the emojis now have multiple genders.
Exactly, which is what gender equality is all about.
Isis Madrid is the world's social media editor. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jeb.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. Big night tonight in Rio with the opening ceremonies for the Summer Games. But I'm wondering, how do Rio residents, cariocas as they're called, feel about hosting the Games? Well, our colleagues at the BBC have been asking a few of them. Let's start with Catherine Miller. She'll be competing for Brazil's fencing team.
Having the Olympics in Rio, especially as I'm on the Brazilian team, is just incredibly special to be a part of the host nation's delegation. With all of our friends and family, you know, being able to be there and support, I just think it's going to be such a surreal, amazing experience. And I mean, I still can't even believe that I'm going, and I'm just so excited. I was born and raised in New York, and my father was born and raised in Brazil, and just very proud that I've been able to forge my own relationship with it, you know, make my own friends, my own connections, find my place in the country. I hope I can do everyone proud. My very first memory is from 96 when the U.S. was hosting in Atlanta and the Olympic torch passed by where I was living at the time in New York, and I touched the torch. You know, the Olympics, what's so cool about it, it's this great historical tradition of like achieving excellence and bringing people together from all over, and that's something to celebrate. And I feel like we've kind of lost sight of that a little bit recently, and I hope that once the Olympics start, that's where the focus shifts.
Not everyone in Rio is excited for the Games. There were protests even as the Olympic torch arrived in the city. That didn't surprise Pedro Henrique Pontes Lima Assi. He runs a bar in Rio.
Brazilians are funny this way. Half of the people, it's pessimists, and half is optimists with this event here. But in the deep heart of everybody, they know that it will be very good for country, very good for the city. We'll have problems, but in the end, we'll be a great event and everything is going fine. I think it will be a great legacy, starting with the metro and the subway, plus the new streets that they are making, and the economy, because Brazil is stopped the economy, and it will be very good for us.
Another Rio resident, Mariana Fonseca, has really mixed feelings about the Games. She's a medical student and a frequent visitor to Rio coffee shops.
If I could choose not to have the Olympics here this year, I would choose not to, but I can't.
I think in a different context, that would have been very exciting. But right now, with all the economic crisis and all the political circumstances, there is a lot of negativity about it. But at the same time, I think the games are coming anyway, so we have to do our best to make them the best games ever. Engaging with the people who are coming would be a nice exchange, a cultural exchange. Not only the athletes are coming, but the tourists and everybody. And I think it's a very nice thing. Rio has hosted some international events before, like during the World Cup. So there were lots of people here from all over the world. And that's always interesting. It brings a different atmosphere to the town. I don't think there will be any particular problems concerning the games right now. The problem will come afterwards when we have the impact and the burden of having hosted the games. For now, I think we should just enjoy it. Everywhere you can see the panels and everything about the Olympics, people talking about it, and it's in the media. I think it's always a bit tarnished because of the negative coverage and the problems, and like about the Olympic Village, they had some problems with it. But at the same time, there is a different point of view to things. There are problems, yes, but it's not all bad. Definitely there is this sense of excitement of big event coming to town. We hope everything will run smoothly. We'll do our best.
There you go. Three cariocas, three different takes on the Olympics starting up in Rio. Tonight's opening ceremony in Rio is a reminder of all the rituals associated with the Olympic Games. You know, all the athletes parading around the stadium, each national delegation led by that country's official flag bearer. Olympic tradition calls for each flag to be dipped slightly as it passes in front of local dignitaries in the stands. But here's the thing. Team USA doesn't observe that tradition. And my colleague, Edgar B. Herwick III, runs the Curiosity Desk here at WGBH. And when he heard about this, he just had to find out more.
Well, it honestly all started with a tweet which I saw from the publication Mental Floss. And they sort of had a link to an article they'd done some years ago that said, why doesn't the U.S. dip its flag? And just dip its flag. I was like, what?
What is that?
So, you know, I read that and it left a bunch of questions for me still unanswered. So I decided to kind of go to the source and find out a little bit more about it.
So what is the ceremony and why do U.S. athletes refuse to dip the flag?
So it all started in 1908, and we're not exactly sure why, but legend says the reason was the flag bearer that year for the United States was a shot putter named Ralph Rose. He was an Irish-American, as were a lot of the folks on that team. The Olympics were in London, and the suspicion is that because the Irish team then had to compete under the Union Jack, he refused to dip the flag to the Union Jack and to British officials in protest.
And so here I am thinking it's American exceptionalism, but it may have been
Irish-American exceptionalism or an Irish protest. So there is this protest thing to it. And then it's a mixed bag for a while, right? So we dipped it in Sweden in 1912. We didn't dip in Belgium in 1920. We dipped again in Paris in 24. But when it really becomes a true tradition for the United States is in 1936. Both the Summer and the Winter Games were in Germany and Hitler's Germany. And it was decided by the USOC that year that our policy was we were not going to dip the flag. In fact, we thought about not going to those Olympics. But what we settled on was we're not going to dip the flag.
Which you can understand. How does it play today? Do people get offended? Do they notice?
Well, it's interesting. So what happens is in the 1940s, the United States adopts a federal flag code. And from then on, we have not dipped the flag from 1936 on. And
so it says in the code, do not dip the flag?
It says that the United States flag shall be dipped to no person or no thing. It's right there in the flag code. And we have sort of depoliticized it over the years and say, well, it's, you know, it's in the code. And certainly in the early years, it was seen as a little bit of American exceptionalism, American braggadocio by other countries. But interestingly, once the Soviet Union enters into the Olympic movement in the 50s, they stop dipping their flag. Then there's a little bit of a flag arms race. And it got to the point where in 1992 in Albertville, 60 of the 64 countries did not dip their flag.
Wow.
So now it's something of a mixed bag. Some countries do dip their flags, some countries do not dip their flags, but since 1936, the United States of America has not dipped their flag.
Edgar B. Herwick III runs WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Edgar, thank you very much. I never know what you're going to come up with next.
Neither do I.
That's our show this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Jeb Sharp. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.